Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Our topic is a very important one on today's morning show, ending gun violence. And no one is working harder on this important issue than Shannon Watts, founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, which is one of the leading advocacy groups when it comes to the matter of gun violence and sensible gun control. And this is a group which, as the name suggests, is comprised pretty much entirely of moms. And Shannon Watts herself is a mother. And it is her fervent belief that mothers have something unique, very special, and very effective to bring to this incredibly important issue. And that's what she writes about in her new book called Fight Like a Mother: How a Grassroots Movement Took on the Gun Lobby and Why Women Will Change the World. And in this book, she not only tells the story of what prompted her to create this group, but also some of the key tenets that have been a guiding force in how this group has gone about doing what it has done on this issue. And she talks frankly about some of the setbacks and disappointments that have been part of the struggle, but also the many commendable victories and triumphs, some of which were really surprising against all the odds. The book again is titled Fight Like a Mother: How a Grassroots Movement Took on the Gun Lobby and Why Women Will Change the World, published by HarperCollins. Shannon Watts, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I'm very, very honored to speak with you. So tell us about the morning of December 14th, 2012, which is when all of this began for you.
Yeah, I was a stay-at-home mom of 5. I had been a corporate communications executive before that, but I'd been home about 5 years. And I can remember folding the laundry and watching the news and saying to myself, please don't let this be as bad as it seems. And as we all know, it was really worse than the human mind can fathom, that 20 children and 6 educators would be slaughtered in the sanctity of an elementary school. And at first, like so many Americans, I was devastated, but that quickly for me turned into anger and outrage that lawmakers weren't keeping our families and our community safe, but also that I was seeing pundits on my TV telling me the solution to this problem was, in fact, more guns. So I went online and I thought, okay, I'm going to join something like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, but for the issue of gun safety. And really all I could find were think tanks in Washington, D.C., mostly run by men, and some one-off organizations in states or cities, also mostly run by men. And I knew I wanted to join an army of women to fight on this issue. And I just thought, okay, I'll start a Facebook page and have that conversation. Keeping in mind, I only had about 75 Facebook friends at the time. I was not a social media phenom. But what happened was lightning in a bottle. You know, all of these type A women started Googling me and finding my phone number and my email and saying, I want to do this where I live. And what I intended to be an online conversation very quickly became not just an offline movement, but we are now the largest grassroots movement in the country.
It's an incredible story in and of itself, and we'll talk more about kind of the logistics by which this group grew so quickly and in ways that you could not possibly have envisioned. I wonder if you would tell our listeners about the story you tell about your son, Sam, a boy at the time, and a very sensitive young boy who had really been quite traumatized by earlier incidents of gun violence. I don't mean it was something that he directly experienced in his own life, but hearing about certain incidents was quite upsetting to him. Explain your son's reaction to Sandy Hook because that was, in a sense, a very powerful moment for you in all of this.
It was. So my son had always been a somewhat anxious kid, certainly made more anxious by the lockdown drills he was experiencing in his school. And he went to the movie Batman with his, he has four older sisters, and they wanted to take him. He was, I think, 11 or 12 at the time. And they were getting ready to go see it. And this was July, I believe, before the Sandy Hook tragedy. It was in 2012, that summer. And all of a sudden, the news was coming on the, in the kitchen about the shooting that had happened at the midnight screening in Aurora, Colorado, of Batman. And I didn't even imagine that this would impact him so strongly. So he saw the news. He heard that it had happened. He didn't seem to react in the moment. But then he went to the movies with his sisters, and he began to have an anxiety attack. He was worried people were armed, that people would come in the doors of the theater. And he ran out, and they followed him, and he was crying. And they took him home. They left the movie in the middle. And that really began months and months of Sam sleeping on my bedroom floor, being afraid of being shot. We ended up taking him to therapy, and eventually he started being less afraid. This trauma for him sort of faded into the background, and he was behaving more normally. So when Sandy Hook happened, I thought, oh, no, you know, this, here we go again. He's going to see this news, and he's going to hear about it at school, and we're going to go back to that place of where he was 6 months ago. And instead, he had the exact opposite reaction. When I sat him down and told him what had happened at Sandy Hook, his reaction was, well, that's just what happens in America, Mom. And that was just as frightening to me, that this had become so normalized even among kids in America, that this was the, this is what happened in schools and in public places. And it made me realize even more strongly that I had to act.
Mm. At one point in the book's introduction, you say, Fight Like a Mother, that's the title of this book, is part manifesto, part memoir, and part manual. Those are really intriguing words. I mean, I know what is behind them because I've read the book, but for the sake of our listeners who I'm quite sure probably have not yet had a chance to read your book, in what way is this part manifesto, part memoir, and part manual? And was that your intention right from the start as you began writing it?
It was. You know, I have gotten calls mostly from women, and I do want to say Moms Demand Action, much like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, is mothers and others now. We have men and non-moms, which I'm very proud of, but I've mostly received calls from women saying to me, how do I do something like this? How do I create a movement in my neighborhood or my community or my state around an issue, not even necessarily gun violence prevention? And how has activism impacted you in your life as someone who really was an accidental activist? And then how do I take these skills and turn it into something even bigger and more meaningful? And so the memoir part of Fight Like a Mother, I talk very personally about how going from being a stay-at-home mom to a full-time volunteer activist has impacted my relationship with my family, with my husband, with my friends. I kind of went from doing whatever I wanted to being busier than I've ever been in my life overnight, and really serving as the tip of the spear on an issue that has a lot of volatility and trolls. So I talk about that. In terms of a manual, I wanted to give very specific examples of how we were able to organize the largest grassroots movement in the country, how we really didn't know what we were doing at the beginning. I talk about how we built the plane as we flew it, that you don't need to know everything, but you can jump in, and sometimes waiting to jump in can be a detriment. And I also, in terms of the manifesto piece, we have had so many of our volunteers decide, especially after spending time in their state houses and realizing that their representatives are not rocket scientists, that they want to move from shaping policy to making it. And I talk a lot about in here, in Fight Like a Mother, about how really, women have a moral imperative at this point in our country to run for office. Doesn't matter if it's school board or city council or Congress. 40 of our volunteers ran in November, 17 won. And I think that is also an important way to change the culture of gun violence in this country.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Shannon Watts. She is founder of Moms Demand Action and the author of a new book about the efforts of the group. It's titled Fight Like a Mother, How a Grassroots Movement Took on the Gun Lobby and Why Women Will Change the World. The framework of most of the book is around 11 principles or tenets that have really guided the work of Moms Demand Action. And the first one that you spell out is use momentum with M-O-M, the first three letters capitalized, so they stand out. So it's really the word momentum, but with mom right at the front of it. And really in this book, you talk about how moms, and particularly moms who might not ever think of themselves as activists, in fact, you call them accidental activists in many respects, in many cases being activists for the very first time in their lives, at least in this dramatic way, are actually wonderfully equipped to do a lot of this work. Explain some of the ways in which it really does fall naturally from the role of the typical mom to be engaged in this issue, in this battle, in this way.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Women and moms have always been on the front lines of activism in this country. If you look at where the origin started, it was with prohibition. Temperance was considered a Christian moral imperative, and so women were allowed to get in activism, and we really never turned back. I mean, if you look all the way up to the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, it's mainly moms and women on the front lines. And I really have come to believe that moms are the secret sauce to organizing in this country. I also felt intuitively in 2012 that moms were the yin to the gun lobby's yang, that they had made this vocal minority of extremists afraid their guns would be taken away. But regardless of political party, 80 million moms in this country are afraid that their children will be taken away. And moms come to the table of activism with so many built-in skills. You know, we already negotiate in our families many peace treaties among kids. We are experts at time management and multitasking. We make about 80% of the spending decisions for our family, and that requires knowing how to budget and manage money. So all of these different skills that we use in our daily lives are also what makes an excellent activist. And the other thing I'll say about that, it was so important to me to have an organization where women and moms did everything soup to nuts. So often you see women doing sort of the menial tasks of activism, like setting up chairs or getting venues or making snacks, you know, kind of behind the scenes. And then often men are in charge of the strategy or get the spotlight. And what I'm so proud of with Moms Demand Action is that even though 80% of our lawmakers in this country are men, on this issue, women are given an opportunity to be empowered and to lead.
I have never seen until I read your book a term called naptivism. N-A-P-T-I-V-I-S-M, naptivism. And you say from the very beginning, our group has advocated something we call naptivism.
Yes.
Explain to our listeners what this term is all about. It's in a sense, lighthearted, but there's a lot of meaning behind it.
You know, so often I think a gating factor that moms don't necessarily get involved in issues they care about is because they're so busy. And I know this is a mom of five, especially if they have small kids. And they may think that even the hour they have doesn't matter. And we show them that it does. We take all interested volunteers. You don't have to carve a full-time job out of your week where you may also be working or be a stay-at-home mom. You can be an activist no matter how much time you have. And naptivism for us really started back in 2013 when we were supporting President Obama and the senators who were proposing something called Manchin Toomey. And that is a bill that, in the wake of Sandy Hook, would have forced a background check on every single gun sale in this country. And we were working very hard to pass this bill and to support this bill. And a woman came up with a video on how do you call your members of Congress when you have time, and that's typically when your kids are napping. And it was really powerful video because, you know, I had certainly never called a lawmaker before in my life, and it can be intimidating. You may think you don't know enough, don't know what to say. You might get the feedback you don't want, but you have to make those calls. It's so important that lawmakers hear as much from us as they do the other side. And so she made this video, and we started a term called naptivism. And how can you take essentially the time that you have and turn it into meaningful action?
I like that so much. And I also like the fact that in this chapter you talk about how it is important for a mom who is an activist to not hide the fact that they are a mom, that is something that one should own proudly. And I think what you're saying there is it's not that moms are embarrassed to be moms, but moms, when they become activists, maybe sometimes feel like they need to shed that part of their identity and take on some other identity in that moment, in that fight. And you are saying, no, go into the fight, go into the fray as a mom and proudly proclaim that you are a mom, because it's because you're a mom that you're there in the first place.
That's right. You know, women are the majority do the majority of caretaking in this country. And it is fair for us to fight this battle as people who are charged with that task. You know, we want to keep not just our own family safe, but our communities. And that is an important mantle to wear in this battle. And what's really been interesting is that lawmakers really want moms to stand behind them and to support them. And when I started Moms Demand Action, I can remember I got a call from Representative Carolyn McCarthy, who joined Congress in the 90s because her son and husband had been shot on the Long Island Railroad. And she said, you know, we've been waiting for women and moms to get involved in this issue as women and moms. And this is also where it's so important to point out that, look, I was a white woman in the suburbs, and I was scared my children weren't safe in school. But what I've come to realize is that 100 Americans are shot and killed in this country every single day, and that women and mothers have been fighting, particularly in our city centers, women of color, whose communities have been ravaged by gun violence. And it's so important that we care about all of it, not just the mass shootings and the school shootings, but the gun violence in city centers, the gun suicides in rural communities, the unintentional shootings by children who have easy access to guns that are not safely stored. All of it matters, and all of it has to be addressed.
We're speaking with Shannon Watts about her book, Fight Like a Mother, How a Grassroots Movement Took on the Gun Lobby and Why Women Will Change the World. She is the founder of Moms Demand Action, which is an immense grassroots initiative, 6 million strong and growing by the day, and they are taking on the issue of gun violence. As we said earlier, your book is framed within these 11 basic tenets that in many ways have guided the work of the organization. Before we just talk about at least a couple others, I wonder if you could say a word about the way in which you have handled the whole matter of what kind of leader to be and what kind of leadership to exert over this huge organization that you created. That is no small matter. And there are probably plenty of laudable organizations and initiatives that have ultimately foundered because of either a lack of leadership or the wrong kind of leadership. What kind of principles have guided you specifically?
Oh, that's such a great question. You know, I had been, as I mentioned, a corporate communications executive for Fortune, 100 companies for years. And certainly the leadership that I exerted there, where I had paid employees working for me who really had to do what I said, is a completely different type of leadership than working with volunteers who, out of the goodness of their hearts, are carving out time to work on an issue that you all collectively have decided is important. And it has been such an honor and such a wonderful experience and such an experience of growth for me to realize that you lead with gratitude and with courage and with love. And that really is ultimately what our organization is about. And we've created this brand that makes women feel empowered. We wear red T-shirts that say Moms in Action. That was long before the Trump administration and their red hats. And it makes, it's almost, I've had volunteers say to me, it's like wearing a superhero cape. Because when they join so many other women and moms in state houses and in boardrooms, they feel empowered and even have gotten tattoos of our logo or our organization's name or One Tough Mother. And that is partly lightning in a bottle, but it's also because of the way we've decided to lead together. And again, it's giving women the opportunity to not just do the unglamorous heavy lifting of grassroots activism, but to set the strategy and to be in the spotlight where they live. And I think we've just created this recipe for success, and it's why we have grown exponentially.
One of your tenets is build a big tent, and the primary focus, at least of the chapter where you write about that, is the matter of making sure that your group is richly inclusive, particularly when it comes, for instance, to having women of color and of various socioeconomic backgrounds and so on. But just that notion brings to mind kind of an unrelated question, which is, to what extent have you sought to be a nonpartisan group? And I should think that that is particularly challenging when, at least in many instances, this battle over gun control legislation can really feel like an extremely partisan issue when it comes to trying to get legislation passed.
Right.
How careful have you been about trying to make sure that your membership, in fact, is not too specifically weighted in one political party to the exclusion of the other?
In terms of diversity, that is incredibly important. It is a priority for us. Last year, over 40% of our hires were non-white. We have been training in what's called DEI, diversity and inclusiveness, within the organization with the goal of making our leadership as diverse as possible. When we started this organization, many of the women looked like me because they were worried about school safety. We worked very, very hard to make sure that we were being diverse, and then Parkland happened, and we tripled in size, and many of the women who came into the organization, again, look like me. What we've learned is that the work never ends, that you always have to make sure that it is a priority and that it is something you're working very hard to do. But that diversity also includes people of different political parties. It also includes gun owners. We are not against the Second Amendment. Many of our volunteers are gun owners, or their husbands are, or their partners. We have a group in the Midwest called Camera Moms, and they hunt together. So that is an important part of our diversifying. And then in terms of being nonpartisan, this is not a partisan issue. And what we've learned is that we're not going to unelect every single representative who disagrees with us, but we can change hearts and minds. And we have done that many times with Republicans and Democrats alike. And in order to do that, we have to have people from all political backgrounds joining and leading the organization. And that is incredibly important because this is a nonpartisan issue. This is about saving lives. We realize that people live issues, lives that contain multiple issues that they're interested in. But our organization is focused on a single issue, and that is gun violence prevention.
One of the unpleasant aspects of the work that you have been doing is that you and other members of the organization have been the target of what you call bullies, and that's a perfect word to describe what's at least some opponents to you have done. And it happened within 24 hours of when you made that first initial posting on Facebook. Give our listeners some sense of the kind of bullying, particularly cyberbullying, that you have had to endure, and what you have, in a sense, learned about coping with that and responding or not responding to it.
Yeah, you know, there was an underbelly of America that I didn't realize existed, that I would immediately receive threats of sexual violence to myself, to my four daughters, right after, I mean, within hours after starting Moms Demand Action. And it was shocking at first. I will say that over the years it has become like white noise or background noise, that I realized that these are people who want to silence and intimidate not just me, but all of our volunteers. And I am happy to serve as the tip of the spear and receive that incoming while our volunteers go about doing the hard work on the ground. But even just in the last few weeks, the NRA has targeted me on Instagram and on Twitter, tagging me with the attempt to centralize my way. And again, received horrible, horrible death threats. But I really feel emboldened by that kind of behavior. If we lose our children, we have nothing left to lose. So the option of sitting back and continuing to allow gun lobbyists to write our nation's gun laws is just not an option.
Hmm. Could you tell our listeners about relatively early on in all of this, when you got a phone call from a woman in Indianapolis? This is one of my favorite stories in the whole book. It ties back to this whole matter of cyberbullying and trolls and so on. Please tell our listeners about this woman who called you out of the mm-hmm. blue one day.
The most amazing thing to me is that every single obstacle that has been in my way since I started this organization has been sort of miraculously removed. And an example of that, when I started the Moms Demand Action Facebook page, there were survivors, including survivors from the Sandy Hook shooting that had just happened, who were sending me their stories and their family's photos. And I was posting them on Facebook for them and telling their story and why it was so important to support stronger gun laws in honor of their families. And these trolls that I was just referencing, they would get on and just post the most horrific things on these Facebook posts. And it was so frequent that it was almost like a full-time job in itself. I was trying to get this organization up and running, but then all of my time was being invested in making sure that these people were blocked, that their comments were deleted, and it was incredibly time-consuming. And there was a day when I was literally laying on my closet floor, looking up at the ceiling, with tears streaming down my face, thinking how overwhelmed I was and how I wasn't sure how I could do all of this by myself. And a woman found my phone number online, called me and said, I live in Indianapolis. She was actually just miles away. I am disabled. I am at home full time. I noticed you have a lot of trolls on your social media outlets. I would love to take over and just spend my day blocking and banning and deleting for you. And she did it for years as a volunteer. And it's just one example of so many times that when I thought we couldn't go on, we did.
Incredible. Do you have time for just a couple more questions?
Yes, sure.
I want to be sure that we talk for a moment about the chapter called Losing Forward.
Mm.
And I really appreciate that this is here. This is a chapter in which you talk about some of the setbacks that are almost always part of these sorts of efforts, because you are, of course, battling against a very powerful lobbying group called, namely the NRA, and a lot of cultural and societal forces that stand in the way of even the smallest steps towards further gun control. You have had lots of victories, but there have been some very, very painful setbacks and defeats as well. I wonder if you could explain to our listeners what is behind this notion of losing forward. I think it's very valuable and also probably applicable even to other issues beyond the one we're talking about today.
Absolutely. You know, this work is a marathon, not a sprint. And we knew going in it was going to be a David versus Goliath battle and that we would lose a lot. And we know from polling our volunteers that one of the most inspiring things to them is winning. It's why they stay involved and fight for so many years. But we're also going to lose, and we do lose. And when we lose, we have to make sure we're making the most out of that loss so that we can eventually come back and fight that same battle and win it. My favorite example of this is Arkansas, and I can remember traveling to the state many times, mostly to Little Rock, where we would have a handful of volunteers show up, and it was just, it was one of the hardest states to organize in because I think they felt it was so hopeless. And what's interesting is what inspired our growth eventually in that state was that a guns on campus bill passed through the legislature and was signed into law by the governor with a gun lobbyist standing next to him. And not only did it allow guns on college campuses in Arkansas, it even allowed them in Razorback Stadium where alcohol is served. And women and mothers in Arkansas were so angry that this had happened that suddenly we went from about two local groups to over a dozen. And they started fighting on this issue and, in fact, were able to carve out that Razorback Stadium allowance, a small step forward, automatically, immediately. And then two of our volunteers ran for office. One was a professor in Fayetteville, and she won her seat in the State House. And another was a retired nurse who was a Moms Demand Action volunteer who took on the lawmaker who put the guns on campus bill forward. She beat him by 12 points. She is now a state representative. And then this year, they took that newfound political power, and they were able to stop the entire agenda of the NRA in the state of Arkansas, including a Stand Your Ground bill, which certainly would have passed without these volunteers refusing to let lawmakers put their community in harm's way. And that is losing forward. You know, what could have been just a guns on campus bill that passed and became the law of the land and then gave the gun lobby carte blanche to continue to pass their deadly agenda was stopped in its tracks, and that is losing forward.
I appreciated reading, actually, in this chapter that your group has a 90% track record of killing what you call as bad NRA-supported bills every year. And I suspect that this is the kind of thing that does not necessarily make the headlines to the same extent. And yet I'm sure you see this as extraordinarily important work, a very important facet of your advocacy efforts.
That's right. So playing defense is something we never realized going in would take up so much of our time. We certainly thought, oh, we'll just try to pass good gun bills, not realizing that the NRA had been insidious in state houses at taking away, for example, the rights of cities to pass laws that are different than states because they fit their communities, or passing permitless carry, or guns on campus, or arming teachers, all of these bills that the NRA shows up year after year and tries to pass through state houses. And we realized that this was something we needed to do, that we had to stop these bills. And as you said, we have a 90% track record of stopping these bad bills. Last year, we were able to stop over 1,000 bad bills across the country that the NRA was trying to pass. And at a federal level, I think what a lot of people don't realize is that the NRA invested over $30 million in Donald Trump's campaign. And the reason they did that was because they thought they would immediately go into Congress and pass two priority pieces of legislation, one called Concealed Carry Reciprocity, which would have made the lowest state laws the law of the land in order to get a gun permit, And the other would be to deregulate silencers, which is a cash cow for gun manufacturers. We were able to stop them for 2 years in a row, despite the fact that they had a Republican president and a Republican Congress. They were not able to pass their priority legislation. It's a non-issue now that the House is no longer in Republican control. But that was, in itself was a huge feat of making sure that we are playing as good of defense as we are offense. Hmm.
I also want to make sure that I ask you about a very surprising statement that you make in the fifth chapter of the book, which is called Use Your Bullhorn, which is really mostly about social media and the incredible effectiveness of social media, which in a sense goes without saying. But I really appreciate the fact that you have some very valuable insights in this chapter, including several things that had absolutely never dawned on me. And one of the most provocative things you say in this chapter is when you say, I view social media as a woman's bullhorn. You go on to say, I mean, or explain that you see a lot of ways in which this makes such a difference, particularly for the kind of moms that are part of your organization, that it gives them voice in a way that they might not otherwise have. Explain what is behind that really interesting observation, that social media is, as far as you're concerned, a woman's bullhorn.
Well, you know, first of all, I always wonder, how did Mothers Against Drunk Driving do it in the 80s? You know, did they call one another and send letters? I mean, it's amazing all that they accomplished without the tools of social media, because we were, for example, able to get Chipotle to change their policy that allowed open carry inside their stores in just 3 days using the hashtag burritos, not bullets. And there's so many examples of how we have used Facebook to organize and Twitter to advocate and Instagram to tell stories. I mean, there's just so many important ways that we can use social media that make it easier to apply pressure to influencers. That being said, when you look at the gatekeepers of our legislature and our companies and our media, they are mostly men. And what I have found over the years is that middle-aged women aren't exactly attractive to those gatekeepers and telling their stories. And we are essentially invisible in our culture. We're not young, and we're not men. And that makes us many times invisible, particularly women of color. And I think what's so important about social media is that we can bypass those gatekeepers. I now have over 300,000 followers on Twitter that I can tell directly without any kind of filter. You know, there are shows that haven't had me on for 6 years, even though they've had men who do the same work on to talk about their wins and to talk about their work. And we have not been given that same opportunity. And so I use social media and where I have followers to not just tell the story of my book or myself, but about our volunteers, work that would not get a light shined on it otherwise. And I think that's such an important use of the tool to empower and embolden women, to thank them, but also to make sure that the stories are out there of what's really happening on the ground.
Right. And I think you do a really nice job of spelling out a number of ways in which social media can be so helpful, particularly to maybe a beleaguered volunteer in some place who feels very isolated and alone, helping them remember that they are not alone. I love your chapter also about volunteers, about making sure that we appreciate who volunteers are, and that we not in any way kind of denigrate the notion of who volunteers are. And I really appreciate something that you say about the very specific and personal word of welcome that every new volunteer of Moms Demand Action receives. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, so first of all, thanking volunteers is so incredibly important. And my favorite part of my job is that every week I'm given a long list of volunteers who leaders have said this person did extraordinary work, or this person needs a pep talk. This person could really use some advice or some thoughts. And that is my favorite time of the week, because I am so honored to get to call and to thank them. And I just think that that is in such short supply generally in volunteering and in activism, but even in the workplace. So that is a policy we instituted early on. The other thing we noticed is that people often wanted to get involved in this issue or to join, and they didn't get a call back. And if you want volunteers to, A, feel valued, but, B, be part of your organization, it's not enough to just ask them to do something. You have to welcome them into the organization. We have an entire network of volunteers who spend their volunteer time making calls to welcome people into the organization, and not just to welcome them, but to say, here are the things that are happening in your community. Can you attend? Because we've also found that when we can put eyeballs on someone, that they're more likely to stay involved in the organization. And I think that's also been a very important part of the recipe for our success.
Mm-hmm. Your chapter called Be Seen goes into really great detail about the importance of branding. And I love so mm-hmm. much of what is there. I really hope people will take a look at that. I want to make sure that we have time to talk about the eighth chapter, which is called Know Your Numbers, because we began this conversation in a very emotional place, talking about the emotional, passionate urgency with which you took up this cause and the millions of other moms that have taken up this cause. But this is not just about the visceral emotional reaction one has to an unspeakable tragedy. This is also about knowing the data, knowing the facts, and being armed with those facts when it comes to really tough political battles. Say a word, first of all, about what the data has convinced you in terms of the three policy areas where lives, in fact, can and are saved. So much of this whole issue really swirls around this.
That's right. And the research and the data is in. Whether or not people choose to believe it and act on it is more of the issue than whether the data shows that stronger gun laws work. We know they do. When you look at states that have stronger gun laws, you see fewer dangerous people getting guns, and you also see more lives being saved. We have closed the background check loophole now in a total of 21 states. We have passed laws that disarm domestic abusers in 28 states. We've passed red flag laws in 15 states, and a red flag law allows family or police to petition a judge to remove the guns of someone who appears to be a danger to themselves or others. All of these laws, when you look at them and the data comes in, show that they are effective in keeping guns away from people who may be a danger to themselves or others. We saw in Connecticut a red flag law decrease the amount of gun suicides. We see here where I live in Colorado that closing the background check loophole kept guns out of the hands of people who were trying to buy them, who were prohibited purchasers. We have done reports that show that when you disarm domestic abusers, you save the lives of women. So the data is in, and we are a research-driven organization. We often show up at state houses where lawmakers are giving us anecdotes about how they believe more guns and fewer gun laws are the answer to our gun violence crisis. We have data, research-proven, valid, credible data that shows the opposite is true. And it's just so important that when we're having these discussions, they are based in fact. And we want to make sure our volunteers are educated so that when they are in state houses and boardrooms and in Washington, D.C., that the conversations they're having show how these laws save lives. And what I'm so proud of is that last year we passed stronger gun laws in 20 states. 9 of them were signed by Republican governors. And that's because the data shows that it will protect their constituents.
Hmm. You write, being armed with data helps in so many ways. Research is like the Swiss Army knife of activism. Which is a great way to say it. And you go on in this chapter to spell out more about the way in which people can really discern the most trustworthy sort of data. I so appreciate the personal touches that you also tie into this book, including the challenges that this has posed to your marriage with your husband, who has been supportive, but it has not always been easy, what it's been like for your children to experience all of this, and the way in which you see a plus in that this activism has taken you, in a sense, a little bit out of your children's lives, but in a way that perhaps is healthy for all of you, since you were by nature kind of one of those helicopter moms.
Yeah.
So it sounds like your life is in a very, very happy place, even having taken on this immense responsibility.
Yes, for sure. And I do talk about that at length, how my husband and I turned this different lifestyle, certainly went from being a stay-at-home mom to a full-time activist was challenging, but turned it into something that would make our marriage stronger. My kids are incredibly proud and supportive, and I do think that my type A personality has been importantly channeled into something other than what they were doing in school or what their grades were like, and that has benefited all of us. And I'm incredibly honored to wake up and do this work every day as a full-time volunteer, knowing that we are saving lives and knowing that we are winning this battle. I go around the country talking about how the fact that we haven't had the cathartic moment in Congress that everyone is waiting for doesn't mean we're not winning. It's so important to know what work is happening on the ground and to realize that Congress is where this work ends. It's not where it begins. And we are right now building a powerful movement that will point them in the right direction.
Shannon Watts is the founder of Moms Demand Action and the author of the book we've been talking about today, Fight Like a Mother. I wanted to make sure to mention that the book includes a beautifully written foreword by award-winning actress Julianne Moore, who has become an active participant in Moms Demand Action. She writes at the end of her foreword, "I am proud to be among the now thousands of volunteers along with my now teenage daughter working to change the culture of gun violence in the United States. And I am very proud to know Shannon Watts." The book again is Fight Like a Mother, How a Grassroots Movement Took on the Gun Lobby and Why Women Will Change the World, published by HarperCollins. The author, Shannon Watts. I'm Gregory Berg. And tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be talking about bicycle racing, and specifically all the action that occurs at the Velodrome in Kenosha, one of the oldest bike tracks in the country. And we'll be talking with the coach of a bike team that is planning on going to nationals to compete. On Monday, a very exciting rendezvous of three different college presidents: President Brian Albrecht from Gateway Technical College, President John Swallow from Carthage, and Chancellor Deborah Ford from the University of Wisconsin Parkside. They'll be talking about a new alliance of 18 different colleges and universities here in southeastern Wisconsin who are joining together to confront various issues related to higher education and preparing an adequate workforce for all of the expansion and growth that is going on in our region. You'll hear that conversation on Monday. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. And you can also subscribe to The Morning Show as a podcast. And with the podcast, you actually hear a different Morning Show 7 days a week, not just five. It's available via Spotify, Google Podcasts, or Apple Podcasts. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships